Hey, listeners, a very quick note here. We mention our website at the end of this episode, and since we published the episode, we've actually moved. So just to clarify, we are at take3amp.com, not .org. Again, that's take3amp.com. Happy listening. We're going to dissect it. We have the questions.
We're going to vivisect this thing.
We are. I'm not sure I've ever heard you use that word before. Hey there, I'm Jordan.
And I'm Nick.
We're just two regular guys who love talking about film.
And now we'd like to talk to you.
We decided to break down our discussions into three parts.
Because everyone loves a gimmick.
We discuss our expectations for a film before we watch it.
That's take one.
We give our immediate thoughts following the film.
That's take two.
And finally, we research the film at length to prepare for an informed and in-depth discussion.
And that's take three. So if you love film even half as much as we do, join in on the conversation.
This is Take Three, a movie podcast. Take one. I got Cheerios in my mug and I'm going to eat them right now. I'm going to eat it right now. I'm eating my Cheerios.
Oh, I thought you said I'm on the air right now.
Oh, I'm on the air right now, eat my Cheerios, and
this will be an ASMR podcast by the time I'm done.
No, I'm leaving. Right. If this is what we're doing, ready? I hate that listen, shit. Listen. Talk normally so I can make sure that I can hear you, actually.
Let me just... I was talking
normally. Okay, but I forgot with all the ASMR.
This is me talking normally.
What does ASMR even stand for?
Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. Listen to me.
This Cheerio real quick. Hi, everybody. We're going to talk about Shape of Water today.
I swear to God, if you talk over my ASMR one more time.
Listen. Ready? Did you get tinkles?
No.
Are you getting the tinkles?
You're really proud of yourself, aren't you?
This podcast is sponsored by Cheerios.
No, we're not... Okay, so we're not sponsored by Cheerios.
I wish.
We're going to talk about a movie called Shape of Water. Today it is the reigning Best Picture champion. It's directed by Guillermo del Toro and stars Sally Hawkins and Doug Jones and Octavia Spencer.
Oh, such a good cast.
We've both seen this movie in theaters, but we thought this would be an appropriate one to do since it's the reigning champion, and we are both a big fan of it and the director. Are you excited?
I am so excited to watch this movie again. It is one of my favorites.
There are parts of it I can't remember, so like I am excited to like delve back in. This is going to be good. I just remember sobbing continuously. Yeah.
I was going to say, like on the plus side, there are parts of this movie that I do remember and would love to watch again, so I'm excited. I remember loving it.
I just want to point out to everybody, though, that if he continues to do this Cheerio shit during the movie, I will be doing the take two by myself.
Can you still hear it, though? they'll be done by the
I mean, you can certainly eat them, but, like, don't eat them like that.
I did it. I only did that once. But I'm going to do it again. This is number two. Ready?
Get ready to be tingled.
Take two. We just finished the movie Shape of Water. The Shape of Water.
Yeah, I apparently said Shape of Water, but it's The Shape of Water. I knew that.
I know you did.
And I had forgotten, like, a lot of it. We watched it early this year or late last year. It had to have been early this year when it came in theater, so early 2018. And
yeah, I was going to ask when did it come out?
So it, like... A movie to get Oscar consideration has to premiere in a theater in New York, in Los Angeles, I think like before the end of the year or like sometime in December. But like, I think it went wide. I think it's one of those ones that it went wide a little bit later, maybe like in January or something like that. I'm not even sure that it fully went wide. Regardless, we were able to see it together, and rewatching it now, I legitimately would put this in. It is one of the most well-made movies I have ever seen. I absolutely love this film. I think what is so good about it that I sort of latch onto, and that what makes it so enjoyable to rewatch, is the kindness of the movie. Whereas, like, you do have a conflict, and there are obviously a lot of harsh themes presented, but this movie just has a warmth to it.
That's the word, I think. It's a great word for it. It's like a hug.
Yeah.
I just feel like I got hugged for 2 hours. It was amazing.
Like a really wet, slimy hug.
No, I agree completely. I think this movie is so charming in a way that not a lot of movies are these days, I think.
Yeah, in every respect, it was a callback, I think, to a very different time in cinema. And clearly a time that meant a lot to Guillermo del Toro. Just even with my favorite character, Richard Jenkins, who is a gay cinephile after my own heart. He steals the movie for me. Like I could watch just the conversation he has with the amphibian man in the bathtub when they're just talking about, do you ever wonder like how life sort of got away from you? How do you ever wonder, you know, you like blink and you realize like this is, you're here. And I just love this movie. I swear.
No, I agree. And I feel like there are a lot of things in this movie that were weird. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a movie about a woman falling in love with a fish monster and falling in love in every sense, including...
It's certainly not for everyone, yeah.
But if you haven't seen this movie, I would suggest going into this with an open mind. You have to go into this movie understanding that it is sort of like an adult fairy tale. It's a love story, and it's adorable. It really is. Like, it's such a cute movie. It's such a well-done movie. It pulls at every heartstring.
I like your comparison to a fairy tale because you really do have like this pure, innocent good being Sally Hawkins' character versus what actually might be a little bit of a heavy-handed portrayal, not on Michael Shannon's part, but I don't know if... Okay, let me explain. Okay, so Michael Shannon plays a character that is a racist, a misogynist. Like, he goes as far as to not wash his hands after he pees. I mean, they are literally painting this guy as the freaking devil. And he has no redeeming qualities the entire time.
No.
And whereas Sally Hawkins is this woman who spends her life cleaning up after these men. And, you know, she's mute. She can't speak, but she has just this warmth to her and she's able to spend her time sort of being there for her friends who I love that she can't say anything, but her friends have like a lot to say, like consistently.
Yeah. I mean, talk about what is Sally Hawkins?
Yes. Sally Hawkins.
Gorgeous and so talented. And she sold this role so well, especially like with her sign language. She's not even speaking and she can still convey so much emotion, which I understand that, you know, ASL is so much more than just like signing. I know it has so much more to do with, you know, attitude and facial expressions, but she just did such a great job, I think, with this role. I'm going to reference something you said about him literally being painted as the devil. And I think what he was painted as this man who saw himself as a god. And maybe we saw him as evil because he was evil. But I think the message here was that he was trying to put himself equivalent to a god. And
the devil.
The devil's not God.
The devil thought he was God.
Oh, see, you would know more about this than I would. I don't know.
I feel like I think that is 100% correct, though. Like,
yeah.
It is someone who thinks he's God meets a God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's why he's so threatened.
Yeah.
I cannot find a single redeeming quality. I mean, this man, like, during sex, covers his wife's mouth with his bloody nubs.
His bloody, infected, smelly nubs.
Yeah. Okay. Can we talk about the color palette?
Yes.
It
oh my
is
God,
literally
yes.
is just what a strong visual choice.
Mm-hmm.
I love that it is literally green. There's green in every single shot. I was looking for it every single shot until the one shot they talk about. It's not green. It's teal.
It's teal.
In the Cadillac where they're in the car. Salesman. What is it? What are you? A car dealership.
Yeah. So the color choices in this were 100% deliberate, even down to like the costumes. Like there are times when Sally's or I guess Eliza's costumes change from this green to this red. And it seems to be when she's meeting this monster. It's I think when she has sex for the first time.
Oh, yeah. With the headband that turns red. Yeah. You pointed that out. I never noticed that. That's really cool.
Yeah, first it was her headband, and I think that was when she like first met him and was falling in love with him. And then I think after she had sex with him, her whole outfit changed to red. It was that scene when she's riding on the bus and she's like controlling the water on the window.
I loved that. I think that was like one of my favorite parts, is that realizing that like he was affecting them. You understand like just the power, like without having to do anything that is huge CGI or huge epic, like you're able to understand the power of this creature, you know, that he clearly is godlike. With these like really subtle, small things. And I think that was really important, I think. Like this movie is a very small story.
It doesn't feel like that though.
It's huge heart, it's huge production value and stuff, but it's such a small, very, very intimate story.
It really is. I never really thought of it like that, but you're absolutely right. It is a very small story, but it's told in such an amazing,
like epic way. Amazingly epic would be, I mean, it's really, it feels, you feel like something just washed over you, you know? There is such attention paid to every minor visual detail. He storyboards and does so much artwork before he ever goes out and actually like turns the camera on. And it's just breathtaking. You can definitely tell the attention he pays to this type of
really
stuff.
Is.
This is one more point I need to make. Okay, Octavia Spencer plays the same character in every single movie. She is, it's the same way that Will Smith often plays the same character. Tom Cruise often plays the same character. These are movie stars that are paid to show up and be themselves. And like Octavia Spencer, she does not get enough credit. She should be a freaking movie star. And I know she's... you know, an Oscar winner, very, very celebrated, very, you know, she does get work, but she deserves to be so much more prolific than she is. She's so incredible.
I could not agree more.
She often plays characters that are similar, but I love them. Like,
I do too.
She's so often the voice of reason, the comedic relief. What is like a heart of this film has like 8 hearts in it, but she's a brilliant actress and she does not get enough credit, I think.
I agree. Do you think that she owns an iPhone?
Okay.
Listen,
now I need you to tell this story
because there's a scene.
I need you to witness so I'll stop and be like, look, everything's green. There's a green in every shot. And then he stops it and is like, hey, do you think she owns an iPhone?
Listen.
Why? Why do you question that?
It feels weird to me to think that Octavia Spencer has an iPhone or uses an iPhone, and here's why. She's, like you said, she plays in a lot of period pieces.
Well, she's like been in the 80s or so like the 60s.
She's been in The Help, Hidden Figures. I don't know exactly.
Times that were not iPhone centric,
right? And in this movie there's a scene where she's using a rotary phone, and it just, I don't know, like I cannot see Octavia Spencer using a smartphone. It doesn't like compute in my head. It just doesn't work.
Thank you for that though.
You're welcome. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. These tangents are very important. Thank you.
Well, yeah, good. I'm glad. And she probably would have an Android because she seems like a smart lady.
Oh, jeez. I have a question about this movie. I think that the whole Scar thing seems weird. Not weird, but like not explained enough. I didn't quite. It was so quick when they explained it. He's like, oh, they cut your vocal cords as an orphan. Like, feels like it came out of nowhere.
I guess I don't know what happened to her. No. Yeah.
See, I'm thinking that I missed something and I was hoping that you had an explanation, but like, that was so like, oh, yep, you're an orphan. That must have meant, oh, you got scars on your neck. That must have meant that you got your vocal cords cut. Like, where the hell did that come from?
So when you brought that up or whatever, my immediate thought was going to be what they wound up being. But
oh, I think we could talk about that.
Well, yeah, okay. But like, I honestly, We just rewatched it. I have no idea where she got those scars. I feel like they could not have. That'll be research. We're going to find out where she got those damn scars.
Yeah. I wish that was clearer because I feel like that would offer some better explanation than, oh, she just gets gills at the end of the movie. Like, yeah,
she was attacked by a lion. But like, okay, so I remember the first time we were seeing this movie and I'm like sitting there like sobbing, right, in the movie theater with you. And her scars or whatever turn into gills. And I like look at you like... Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, that never occurred to me. She has three slits on her freaking neck. And that never occurred to me, ever. I promise you, I'm really smart. But, like, that never, ever occurred to me.
No, they showed those scars within, like, the first maybe 30 seconds of the movie. And I'm like, well, I guess she's going to be breathing underwater soon. Like, I didn't pay attention. I don't know if they were just on one side of her neck or both. If they're on both, that... I feel like that's even worse. I feel like, I don't know. That would have been even worse.
I have no idea either. One more point I just wanted to make, and I thought we maybe could discuss it, is I love the fact that throughout the movie, Michael Shannon's character sort of it feels like he has to dumb down his vocabulary or explain his vocabulary to these women because they're just cleaning ladies.
Mm-hmm. They're just the help, as he refers to them.
Yes, exactly.
Awful. Yeah.
But then it turns back on him and Sally Hawkins is able to literally spell out fuck you.
Oh my God.
And
yeah.
He has no idea what she said, what she is talking about.
That's a great
She has no idea.
Point.
They are literally speaking a different language that he does not speak. And I thought that was so clever and so intentional. The throat slashing was lovely as well. But I thought that her being able to say fuck you to this guy and him not be able to even understand, that was so satisfying.
See, that never even occurred to me, and that makes me want to watch the movie yet again. I just adore that movie so much.
Yeah, so if you haven't watched this movie already, well, we kind of just spoiled it for you. But... In take three, we're going to talk a little bit more, less as fans and more try to delve into what things meant. And
we're going to dissect it. We have the questions.
We're going to vivisect this thing.
We are. I'm not sure I've ever heard you use that word before.
I think that's what they call it. I don't know. But yeah, we're going to do take three now. I'm just kidding.
I was gonna say, did I have
but like now would have been a great time to cut
to edit it.
What? Yeah.
Well, see, now it's a surprise. You don't know when it's coming. I could be cut off right now, and it could be take three. We'll mess with that. Make it funny when you edit it. Okay. Is that stupid? Is that stupid?
Take three.
So I did my homework,
and I'm gonna wait.
You asked me earlier today to see my notes, and I'm sure it's just so that you could. It's like being back in high school. You stole my notes.
No, I legit looked up the stuff. I just wanted to see if yours were like gonna eclipse mine. But no, they probably will. But that's okay.
I'm excited to jump into the analysis of this movie. Yeah. Doing this made me love the movie even more.
I totally agree. I think that. You're able to sort of, when you're researching it, we were able to look at it not just as fans and not just like coming right out of the movie. You can look at the movie as a whole, and there were things that I didn't even touch on that I just love, you know, that I think were fascinating that I didn't even bring up in take two.
Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily like the freshest thing in your head, but this allowed us to go back and sort of delve into those types of things.
Yeah. Would you like to go first? What's your first point?
Yeah, I'm going to just do some broad stuff that I think is important. And I don't know if you necessarily know this, if maybe certain people out there didn't.
I probably would.
I'm sure some people do. But this got nominated for a lot of Oscars. And
how many did it win?
It won four Oscars. It won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Musical Score, and production design. And I'm like, if it could have won any Oscars, those were the ones. I mean, I think the production design is
out of this world.
Yes, yeah, stunning.
Yes.
I know that you were very interested in the color palette. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes, that was probably one of my biggest questions, I guess, that I wanted answered, because it was very, like I said, it was very intentional, very deliberate. And actually, through my research, I found out some very interesting things. So the color palette was, like I said, green and red. Green is conforming. It's sort of like the standard. It's not deviation, which is like what
blending in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And which red is the opposite of that, which means deviation from the norm. You can see it very clearly, especially with Strickland, who is Michael Shannon's character, right down to the kind of candy he eats, especially, which I love this scene even more now, with the car. When he goes to get the car, it's sort of like, this is the, if you're a successful businessman, you'll buy this car. And it's sort of, you know, straightforward. It's you know, what's expected of you. It's not out of the...
It's tail.
It is, yeah.
I love that scene so much. Yeah. That is probably one of my favorite scenes with him in it.
Yeah.
Most of the time I'm like, ugh, I hate him, but that's a great scene.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's even with the Jell-O, with Giles, who's Richard Jenkins' character. It was first red, but they said they wanted it to be green. You know, it's this sort of nuclear family kind of thing.
Really? Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. So he's like, they were telling him that he needed to.
Yep.
Oh, shit.
Yep. Okay. And the pie that he ate at the diner was also green, which also tasted like shit. So it's sort of, you know, a running theme.
Oh, man.
Eliza's outfit changes. She was so sort of, you know, typical, just kind of doing her day-to-day business. And then suddenly she meets this monster. Her headband changes red. And then suddenly her outfit changes to red. And then one other thing that I saw, someone had mentioned online that even down to like the blood in the lab, Strickland's fingers got bitten off. There's blood all over the laboratory and they were told to clean it up as quickly as possible. Like they had to get all red out of the scene, out of everything, and I needed to go back to normal. So that was sort of, I thought that was an interesting point.
What a wonderful use of color.
Yeah.
What a wonderful use of production design. So thoughtful. Guillermo del Toro is just
an artist. He's amazing. I mean, again, like all of this made me just love this movie so much more. And it's just so, so amazing.
So this is going to be a lot of us just gushing.
Yes. Very passionate about this movie.
One thing that I did learn was that this was like the be-all end-all for Guillermo. I read an article that said that he claimed because he poured so much of himself into this film and it was so personal to him, if this movie had tanked, it would have been his last one. He'd have retired.
Oh my God.
Thankfully, it did not.
Yeah.
This movie made 10 times its budget.
Oh shit.
It cost $19 million to make and it made over $190
million. Hold up. $19 million for that movie?
It cost $19 million to make.
Oh my God.
$190 million worldwide. Yeah.
19? That's like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
But it's like, that's how you know that a director is like invested. That's how you know that what you are watching is someone's soul printed on film, you know?
That's a great segue for my next point, actually.
I'm great at segues.
What?
I'm great at segues. And I just ruined
it. You,
so you, I'm great at segues. Talk.
I'm sorry. I can't. I'm sorry. Sort of how Guillermo del Toro's history and personal life and just pure soul was poured into this movie. One of the interviews that I saw that he did, he said, words lie, looks don't. And this sort of goes back to the point that I had mentioned about how ASL is so much more than just a language that is spoken with your hands. Like so much of it is expression and sort of, you know, body language and that kind of thing. So he's an immigrant himself, and I sort of read up on some of his interviews about him talking about his childhood. And even from the very beginning, he had such a profound imagination, and he would, you know, draw characters and write stories to the point where his very conservative, very religious grandmother had him exercised twice.
What?
Yeah. He sort of took that and made it tangible in this movie about feeling like you don't belong, and not just with Eliza, it's or the sea monster, it's with Giles, it's with Zelda, even Dimitri, I guess a little bit, but you can definitely tell how personal and how close this movie was to him.
Absolutely.
So when he said like words lie, looks don't, it made sense why he made Eliza mute, because so much more was said. And this is why, kind of random reference here, but this is why WALL-E is one of my favorite movies, because for the first, I don't know, half hour of that movie, there was not a word spoken. And yet so much emotion was portrayed in scenes like that. It's very clear why he made both the sea monster and Eliza. They don't speak.
They came into this movie and were told, hey, you know, you don't have one of your biggest assets, your voice. You're going to have to deliver that performance with everything else you have. The eyes, the body language, yeah. Everything.
And here's a spoiler. They absolutely did. Like, yeah. Sally Hawkins absolutely stole that performance. It was, oh, she did such a good job. I want to see her in so many more things. That was the first thing I'd ever seen her in. It's probably true for many people, but I'm very curious to see what else she's been in.
Oh, yeah. This movie has actors in it you don't even recognize from other movies. Like Michael Stahlberg, who plays, his name is Dimitri?
Yeah, yeah, the Russian
agent guy. Spy. He's mm-hmm. brilliant. And if you've ever seen, or if you have never seen Call Me By Your Name, I mean, he is the best part of my favorite scene of that entire movie. It will rip your soul out. He's so brilliant in that.
I've not seen it, but I find that man just downright adorable.
Yeah, and he is very good looking, for sure. So I have something I want to talk about.
Go for it. I'll allow it.
Okay. I researched this. I don't want to even call it research because I wound up diving into Reddit and conversations, and we were talking about the scars on the neck.
Yes.
And it started to drive me crazy because I was like, this movie is like, doesn't really explain that, and I'm like, what conclusions are we supposed to draw? And I found a rumor that I need to talk to you about that I think is like, I don't even know that it's warranted, but it's so interesting that we've just all got to talk about it. Okay. So the idea was that Eliza, being found near the water when she was younger with those scars already on her, is also part fish herself. And that those scars had been gills the whole time adapting to
the air,
adapting to land.
Yeah.
And you can see this in obviously her choice of mate, but how her sexuality is tied directly to water throughout this film, to her masturbating in the bathtub, to her eventually making love to this fish underwater. She's obviously silent, just like the fish man. And I really thought that was very interesting.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah. And I feel like if we operate under this assumption, then what I think is really cool is that it changes the way you look at the bus scene. Because when she's playing with the water and the water is following her fingers, it's not... Or it's no longer that he left some sort of imprint on her and now she's, it's not like static electricity that she's able to sort of do. He awoken something in her.
It's something that was dormant.
And I love that. I think that is really a very interesting and powerful way to look at this. He didn't necessarily give her those gills. She had them the whole time, and now she has a reason to use them to spend her life with him underwater.
Yeah. He kind of took him out of that like dormant state, I guess.
Yeah.
Like they're old lovers reunited.
It's fascinating.
If there was one thing that I would say that I disliked about this movie, it's those gills. I wish it was a little bit clearer. Maybe not spell it out for us completely, but make it just a little bit more clear than it is now. Because that's an interesting theory. And, you know,
maybe we're just supposed to generate these theories.
Maybe.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I necessarily needed it spelled out for me. I was super enamored and obviously shocked by the transformation she made.
Yeah.
Into a woman with gills. Mm-hmm. So it was honestly something I was never thinking about.
Yeah.
It's not something I remembered. I wasn't thinking like, oh, what is that? What is that? I just was like, oh, okay. That's what her.
Her neck just has three lines on it. No big deal.
Well, I mean, no. They certainly didn't make that big of a deal of it, you know?
No, you're absolutely right. But an interesting transition, you say the word transformation, she kind of transforms into, you know, something similar to this, you know, Aquaman. And one of the biggest comparisons that I saw when I researched this was how close it was to a fairy tale, specifically Beauty and the Beast. And there are a lot of parallels, but also a lot of differences or contrasts that I think are really important to bring up. Specifically for Beauty and the Beast, how the word or the idea of different equals scary. You have this big monster that, you know, is stuck inside this castle. You have this gorgeous woman who comes in, and they sort of learn about themselves and each other along the way, which results in this big transformation that this beast is finally, it turns into something that's more socially acceptable, I suppose. There is a very strict contrast, though, in this movie. You know, in Beauty and the Beast transforms, but in this one, it's sort of like Beauty transforms into, it's not moving towards the green, it's moving towards a very beautiful red. It's moving towards that,
yeah,
that different. And
yeah, that's a really good point. That's
yeah. And in the research that I found, there's this Beauty and the Beast story is very common, specifically in Shape of Water. And also I saw Shrek. Was a great example, because, you know, in the first movie, spoiler alert, Fiona turns into an ogre. It's sort of the beauty turning into the beast.
Yeah.
And it's about accepting different, and it's about accepting the rebellion and finding comfort and peace and love in that.
Yeah. So, I mean, this the bare bones of this story is a tale as old as time. It's not something that we necessarily haven't seen in one way or another. I think what makes this story different is the way it's told, the attention to detail, and the fact that a lot of the sort of tropes of even just science fiction movies are sort of turned on their head.
Oh, yeah.
I love the fact that this is a science fiction monster movie where Michael Shannon's character, Strickland, would normally be the hero in this movie, mm-hmm. and he's not. He's the bad guy, and the monster is essentially the hero. You know, right. The monster wins at the end, and we're happy.
Yeah.
So
that's another note, a small note that I wrote down, was that Strickland is sort of this, I'll say, normal outside with this beast on the inside. And then you have a monster who is sort of, you know, the monster on the outside, but, you know, very beautiful on the inside. And that's where I guess that's where we find our relatability with this monster character. That's why we fall in love with him, and I'm glad that he wins.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think another thing that I don't know that we even brought it up in take two, but I know that it was really sort of interesting that the creature is very largely practical. Doug Jones, I saw in a behind the scenes video that he said that they had gotten, this is a short transformation. I mean, so he said that they had gotten it down a full body transformation. 2.5 hours. That's impressive.
Oh, wow.
For a special effects team,
yeah,
to do. Another thing was that the sort of glowing aspect to him that comes up at certain times.
Yeah, is that practical?
During the movie,
yeah.
Is that CGI? Or is that like sort of like built in, you know, are there lights in his suit or whatever? It's bioluminescent paint. And shot properly, it gives the appearance of glowing.
So that wasn't like LED lights or anything. Is that what you're saying?
No.
That was paint?
Paint, yes.
That's wild. I need to get the DVD for this, the behind the scenes. That sounds amazing.
One other thing that I just have to bring up, though, when we're talking about monsters, Richard Jenkins' narration in the beginning and the end of the movie is very powerful. But the beginning, when they talk about the monster that tried to destroy, you know, this love story, the use of the word monster, I think is really important, because I find myself describing this fish as the fish monster.
Yeah.
But he's not the monster in the story.
Right,
you know,
right.
I think that's really important to know that it's definitely about, and to your point, it's definitely about the inside.
Yeah.
Not about outward appearances.
And what a statement today, like even just, you know, in today's political climate, it's all about, I'm not going to say that everyone has a beautiful inside and should be accepted as such, but I think everyone's so afraid of what they see on the exterior. And if it's at all different from what they're used to, it's scary. And that's, you know, if this movie's anything, it's a lesson that, like, that's obviously not the case, that, you know, there's a beauty in different, and there's a comfort in deviation. And I think
absolutely
there's certainly a peace when people start to accept that.
That is a very important commentary.
I couldn't
on today, back then, mm-hmm. just life in general. The story is in a sense timeless because of that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Guillermo has said that this is a film about pushing forward into the future, where everyone's concerned about using this creature to get one up on the Russians. The Russians want to get one up on the US. Yeah. They're all sort of talking about the space race. And then at the same time, you're dealing with this ancient, powerful force. And that is...
Who doesn't care about the space race? Who doesn't care about the Russians and the Americans? Like, it's...
I think the idea that the people at this facility think that what they're doing is the most important thing in the world.
They're doing God's work.
Yeah, it's God's work. This is going to push man forward. And they don't even realize they're treating something that is...
treating God
more important, more powerful. I mean, Strickland at the end realizes he's like, you were a god.
You really are a god. I don't think that this is even researched, but it's like, here are these men thinking they're doing the Lord's work, thinking that they are, in Strickland's case, better than or equal to a god.
Their country is going to be the best. Their country is going to be the one at the top of the world.
The winner. Yeah.
Because of the work that Strickland's doing, because of the work that the people in that facility are doing.
Which is like inherently evil. Like, it is not at all God's work. And what's so satisfying about this when you think about the ending of the movie is that, like, you know, God wins.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to focus a little bit on Giles. I think he is such a fascinating character. He goes through a very big transformation in this movie, just like Eliza does. It is only when he is turned down with the drawing that he did of the Jell-O family, that's sort of when his internal change, I guess, begins. He sort of sees that maybe he has nothing left to lose. Maybe he finally sees himself as the outcast that Eliza feels like when they had that, oh my God, I'll say it's the best scene in this whole movie is when she is signing to him and she's saying, tell me what I'm signing. And he's sort of narrating what she's saying in such a beautiful way. And she's sort of like, you know, we are monsters if we don't do anything about this. And then that's when he sort of storms out and goes and presents his drawing, which gets turned down. And I think that's the moment when he sort of shifts and he's like, all right, let's do this. Like, clearly I'm an outcast. Like, you guys... let's do this.
I love that. I think that that's actually a really good point. That it's not like he's given up and he has nothing to lose. It's like he's embracing the fact that he too is an outcast. He says, "I have no one," you know.
Yep.
But like, I think what he's saying is, you and I are very, very similar in that we are both people who society has taken for granted. And let's do this to sort of stick it to the man, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think as soon as that happens, you see such a huge shift. You see that his art style, which was originally, I don't want to say photorealistic, but it's less abstract, very to the point, you know, making this Jell-O family. And then all of a sudden you see him in the bathroom with, you know, the sea monster, and he's sort of drawing these beautiful portraits. There's a scene that flashes to his art board and it's the sea monster and Eliza in this beautiful embrace. His art changes, that kind of thing. And one point that I saw that was very interesting was his transformation is represented with his hair. When the sea monster goes and, you know, touches his head and fixes it, his hair grows back. When he's finally accepting himself, when he's finally transformed into someone who can respect themselves and can finally be happy about their actions and is doing this wonderful thing that they think is so inherently good, saving this creature from damnation, his hair comes back. Like, I thought that was such a really, really interesting point.
And I just want to, on that specific point, okay, I do have to admit, I just got into sort of like this tangent with videos and things like that. And I don't know if anyone knows what CinemaSins is. You should. But I watched Everything Wrong with The Shape of Water. And it was like 14 minutes long or whatever.
Those are dangerous. Talking
about all these things that I was just like, this is to each their own. A lot of times they're funny. One of the points that they made is that this creature fixes his hair, but it doesn't all grow back. And I think now that you're saying that, I think it's more of a commentary on, it didn't all grow back. His hair doesn't look perfect at the end, but that's okay because none of them are perfect. None of them, they're Mm-mm. rebels. They're outcasts. They're not.
The point of this movie is imperfection.
Yeah.
Like,
and to embrace that and to know that you can still find love and you can still find mm-hmm. friendship and you can still find, you know, happiness. And that a lot of times the people that are, you know, sitting there telling you that you need to be, you know, this exact way are the people like Strickland who get their throats slashed at the end, you know?
I mean, very strong lesson yeah, here, guys.
Absolutely. Don't fuck with gay people or black people or disabled people because we will get a fish monster and we will slash your throat.
I have nothing else to say.
I'd like to play a game.
No, we thought it would be kind of fun to conclude these episodes with a fun little game.
We're going to recast a movie.
I think it's appropriate for the times, considering everyone is like either remaking movies or doing sequels to older movies. Like,
it'll be fun.
Yes, I can.
Yeah. So this episode, we are going to recast John Hughes's 1985 film, The Breakfast Club, which I mildly enjoy.
So who do you want to start with? Which character?
The nerd.
Alrighty.
Okay, so I'm going to go first.
Okay.
I chose Anthony Michael Hall.
No, oh, I do not know who that is.
It's the guy who played him in the actual movie. I didn't...
Oh.
You're I chose all shit. The original actors.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Just older.
You didn't.
It's like, how did we get into attention again? We're like full-grown adults.
Can you imagine them in jail doing like all the same shticks that they did like
yeah.
in the library? That would be hysterical.
So for the nerd, I selected Lucas Hedges.
Still don't know who that is.
So he's the son in Three Billboards. He's in Lady Bird. He's in the movie Boy Erased about the conversion therapy.
Yeah.
He's in Manchester by the Sea. He's very, very, very good. And I think he would be perfect.
I think that's a great choice. I was going to say that like maybe he resembles the original actor.
Absolutely. I thought so. But then I think he also embodies that sort of like repressed because yeah. he's so sort of like uncomfortable in his skin.
Yeah.
And I think he could probably pull that off.
This was the hardest one for me. I picked two for this because I couldn't pick between either of these. Jesse Eisenberg, who is in The Social Network, Zombieland, American Ultra, or Michael Cera. He's in Scott Pilgrim, Juno, Superbad.
Though yeah.
They both
yeah.
seem like kind of like the obvious choice of like the nerdy kind of character.
I think that like it would be interesting to see if Michael Cera could do something like this where he's a little bit... There are shades in Superbad of him sort of being uncomfortable in his skin and sort of
high school guy just trying to like find his way the best he can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think honestly, like it might come down to Jesse Eisenberg just being a little bit too old.
Maybe.
You know what I mean? Like I think I turned down some people because I thought they're regardless of their age, like there are people in their 20s that are playing people in their 40s, and there are people in their 20s that are playing people in their teens. You know what yeah. I mean? So like I tried to steer with people like that. So who do you want to do next?
Let's do the jock.
Okay. So I have Tom Holland. And I know, like, I get that he's lanky, sort of goofy, like little Spider-Man. But I think that with his acting range and also that sort of like all-American boy look.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people might think like, oh, he's a shoo-in for the nerd. But like I only see him as the jock.
No, that's a great choice. I had Ansel Elgort.
Oh, see? Okay. Yes, I definitely agree.
Yeah, from Baby Driver, Fault in Our Stars. He was in the Divergent series.
I like that a lot. He's very, very, like, all-American guy, sort of.
They're this kind of cool, like, too cool for school kind of.
He can carry himself like that, but yeah. Then there's, like, a lot of depth, I think.
Yeah. Let's do the princess next. I had two for this one. I'm realizing that you're mentioning a lot of movies that overlap, not the same characters, but a lot of mine are in a lot of the movies that you've picked. Catherine Newton from Three Billboards. She plays the daughter. She was in Lady Bird, and she was in Cock Blockers as Julie. I think it's just called Blockers, but she was the daughter.
With the rooster.
Yeah. The other one was Kiki Palmer. She was in the Scream Queens TV show. She was in Aquila and the Bee.
I love her.
Yeah. Yeah. I do too.
I love her. That's awesome.
She can play sort of like that, you know, prissy.
That made me very happy. I like her a lot. I too race-bended the Claire role. I chose Kiersey Clemons, who was in Dope. She was in Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising. She's actually had a bit of a rough time of it with some of these movies. She was slated to be in the new Flash movie until Rick Famuyiwa, the guy that directed Dope and was supposed to direct Flash, left the project, and then that fell apart.
Oh, no.
And then she actually shot scenes in Justice League, and because that movie sort of fell apart, they were cut out of Justice League. Although, good, she was able to, like, jump off that sinking ship, but...
Yeah.
I think she's got, like, a charisma to her. She's gorgeous. I think
she's very pretty.
That, and she is part of the LGBT community. And I would love to see that sort of like brought up somehow in the movie.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Because like, again, like these kids would be facing similar problems, but like in a different
ways. Setting.
I mean, it's a timeless movie, but it can be updated. You know what I mean? It can definitely be modernized probably, honestly, pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do the basket case.
Okay.
I picked this woman because I just want her to be in everything. I love her very much. And like, honestly, she could play this role in her sleep. Anya Taylor-Joy, I love her.
I love her too.
She does such a great job of sort of being this doe-eyed, mysterious character.
For those who aren't familiar, she was in The Witch. She was in Thoroughbreds, just really beautiful, gorgeous actress.
I forget that people might not know who she is. Yeah. If you ever stumble upon her, just watch it. She's incredible in everything.
Very, very great actress. I had two picks until I kind of thought of someone who would be much, much better. My first two picks were Chloe Grace Moretz, who she was in the Carrie remake, Suspiria, Kick-Ass, and Zendaya, who was in Spider-Man and The Greatest Showman. I figured those two would probably do a good job for this. But I think the reigning champion for this role is Olivia Cooke. She was in Ready Player One recently. She was also in Thoroughbreds. Love her, and especially with her role in Thoroughbreds, she can absolutely play this sort of like strange out there person. So I guess all that's left is the criminal, and I'm going to let you go first because I cannot wait to tell you who I picked for the criminal. It is so perfect. There's literally no one else that could play this role. So let's see what you got.
I'm like, nervous. What do you have? Because this is the one I struggle with the most. I picked this guy because I think he's a very talented actor. He's not necessarily been in other films where he's exhibited traits of the John character, but I just think that he could definitely do it. He's got that swagger to him. I picked Alex Wolff.
Sounds familiar. Tell me what he's been in.
Yeah, so he's the son in Hereditary.
Oh, that's an interesting choice. That's a very interesting choice. I support that for sure. Now, you guys don't have the benefit of actually seeing his reaction for this one, but like, I cannot wait to see you just flip out of your chair when you hear this, okay? Talk about a chameleon actor. Evan Peters played in so many roles in American Horror Story, several criminals in American Horror Story.
I think every single one of them.
To me, there's no one else that could play this. I could just see him with a cigarette in his hand, like legs spread, just sitting down, being like just that asshole, just sending a glare through everyone.
You win. That was amazing. I love, love, love
I thought
Evan
so.
Peters and everything. He is a...
Me too.
A consistent high point. I'm thinking maybe one of his characters that he's played on American Horror Story is not a criminal, and he's in jail for being a criminal.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah,
that's a very good point. Yeah, that's to me that was, and he can play such a range of characters that it's like it's a no-brainer for this one.
Yeah, that was very good. Good job.
This was fun. I had a lot of fun with this.
Yeah, this was fun. I just want to remind everyone to send us your recastings and future movies or future games that we could play, or, you know, if you just want to tell us that we're awesome and you love the sounds of our voices, that's totally fine too. Or send us money. That's cool.
Hey everybody, Nick here. We hope you like this episode of Take 3, a movie podcast produced by Jordan Sato and Nicholas Crawford. It was edited by Nicholas Crawford, who struggled a lot balancing these audio levels. So if anyone out there wants to help him for free, you should. This was our take on The Shape of Water. Tune in next week for our take on another shape, Michael Myers, as we delve into Halloween. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Take3AMP. Thanks for listening. Bye, everybody.